if you want to be a guest, please email me. I have received so many emails of people that are excited and passionate about being a guest on this show. The process is time consuming. I go through about an hour long pre-interview and I determine where you'd fit best in the season. So if you've gone through the pre-interview process, or we've messaged back and forth via email and haven't gone through the pre-interview process, I'm not ignoring you. I promise. There's just a lot on my plate and I am one person. So that being said, I look forward to talking with every one of you that is interested in being on this podcast. Y'all are amazing and I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
It was abuse. And saying that feels like a betrayal to my parents, because that is so not where they are anymore. And that is what I think is very interesting about this story and very uncommon with other people who have been raised in jobs and homes. My parents deconstructed. 10 years ago, my parents up and moved to Canada. And being in a different country really opened their eyes to different ways of thinking and different lifestyles. And they have come to all of us kids and they have said, "I am sorry." And it sucks because you hear your parents say, "I'm sorry, I didn't know. I thought that I was doing what was best. I really thought I was." You go to church and you're told by your pastor that this is the way that you're supposed to parent your kid. And they're preaching this shit from the pulpit.
Welcome to the Focus on Your Own Family podcast. Fundamentalist evangelicalism impacted a generation. We survived physical, psychological, mental, and spiritual abuse. We survived the Focus on the Family movement, and we want to talk about it. Trigger warning, guests will be sharing stories of domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. Please listen with caution. Thank you.
Here is Jess. This is her story.
Hey, Jess.
Hello.
Okay, y'all, you're in for a treat. Jess is one of my friends in real life. We have actually seen each other. She has been to my house. And we met through a workout, through a gym. We're not going to name the name. My husband and I were building plyo boxes during the pandemic. So when everything was closed, people could work out. And Jess reached out to me and said that she'd like to get two of them because she heard through the grapevine that we were making these. And so she wanted to get two of them because she said, and I quote, "My husband's super extra and wants to." And naturally, that caused me to push a little forward with that and say, please explain. But now I know your husband and I get it.
100%.
I get it.
Yeah. I stand by that statement.
Yeah. What's funny is just before this, I decided, I wonder what our first interactions were like, because we just messaged over Instagram. And it's very interesting. Outside of just talking about, oh, your husband's extra, we start talking about a church. And you asked if I was a leader at the church that I went to. And then you said, we should definitely grab coffee sometime. And then my response is, I'm not in a leadership role right now. I'm on blank church worship team, but I took a step back about a year ago because I wasn't seeing my family like I wanted to. Yeah, I was absolutely a worship leader at that time. The reason why I wasn't leading worship at that time is because I opened my mouth and spoke against systemic abuse and problems that were happening in that church. And I made the worship, like the creative director, feel very uncomfortable. You put, got it. That's great though. I was the worship pastor at our church for 3 years and then moved into discipleship about a year ago, but I still get to lead worship ever so often. We're pretty progressive. It's hard to be honest and open about it sometimes, but it's important to make sure that people know
that people matter, no matter who they are, what they do, or what they've done. Our job isn't to judge. I leave that to the big guy. My motto is, if I get to heaven and God tells me I love people too much, I'll be okay with that. That was you. This is okay, me.
Hang on. But for the record, I wasn't saying my church is that way. I was saying me and Joey.
You. Yeah. Yes, you and Joey. Yeah.
Are that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the way the church.
No.
And also for everybody's context, I was a pastor at this church.
Yes, totally.
Yeah. I don't think we mentioned that.
Yeah. My response is, gosh, we consistently measure choices with this. Does it honor someone? Am I loving well? And your response, love that.
Oh my gosh.
Me. Jesus's ministry was deliberate. I often ask myself, who, Lord, right now is your woman at the well?
You're going to win them over for Jesus.
Let that sit. There was nothing there. Okay. That's what I was told. I was fed that line by my church. And that's what I was told to say to people is, I'm going to do that. I'm going to win people over for Jesus.
Gross.
I was awful. It's hard to earn the trust of folks. We have destroyed in the name of Jesus, which is actually true. Like,
oh, yeah.
I can recognize that, like, we destroy these people. And then you go on to say the same. You said, yes, yeah, same. I feel like my calling right now is to be Jesus with skin on to those groups as best as I can. Even if it ruffles the feathers of people in the church, it's okay. It's necessary. I seriously want to get coffee with you.
So fast forward, it did ruffle feathers with the people in my church.
It definitely did. Fast forward, it definitely ruffled feathers for the people in my church. You're no longer a pastor, and I am definitely no longer a worship leader. I've said this before. I don't know how famous you have to be to just denounce something, but I denounced the evangelical movement in its entirety a few years ago. Not too long after this, actually. And
I feel like that's what really bonded us, because we were
yes.
like, can we compare notes? And it's okay, cool. No, we are completely on the same page with them.
When I was reading through this, and that's as far as I got, what I see happening is we were testing the waters. How progressive are you? Like, I'm gonna go fishing a little bit to see where are you at? When I say that, who are the women at the well? That's such an evangelical term. I remember even writing it and thinking, okay, if it's safe beyond this point, then I'm going to reveal more of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
And then going further than that, right? I was so nervous knowing, oh my gosh, she's a pastor. So this is going to go one way or the other. But this was in July of 2020. I had officially...
I was so burned out in July of 2020.
Yeah. I was in a space too where I had been to my last exec leadership meeting for the women's ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at that point, started to think, I'm not going back.
Mm-hmm.
I can go back, but I don't know where I sit with this, because I see the systemic racism. I see the homophobia and how terrible they are to really anybody that is not that. It's a mega church, so not that family, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm realizing this. And at the same time, I'm desperate for community, because I recognize if we, at the time, walk, let me say air quotes, walk away, because now I call it escape. But if we walk away from this, we lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
Our spiritual community, our spiritual family, our social safety net, like every single thing. And I was so desperate to find another safe space that I see this through this dialogue. I'm just testing the waters. Is this person a safe space?
Mm-hmm.
I know that, sorry, mm-hmm. I'm glancing at it and it says, it's like me flat out starting to really test you and say how I am pro-choice and I don't feel like there's anything wrong with abortion and the issues with the church. And your response was, you put words to the exact same feelings I have on that topic. And it's at that moment I thought, okay, now we can have a real dialogue. And then we switched to Marco Polo, and it's been like real, the real raw stuff of, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't think I can call myself anything that associates with this. And then just the breakdown, like where we just almost immediately enter into this spiritual crisis, this existential crisis. And
yeah, and this was like a year and a half before I got laid off from the church. And in this time, like a month after that conversation, I had been talking to the pastor at, or like the executive pastor at the church or whatever, and said, I'm super burned out. And I don't know. And like, I wanted to quit then. And he talked me into staying. And then within a year, I was laid off. And in that time, I had gotten pregnant and had a baby, and then was laid off when I got back from my maternity leave. And so it's just fascinating how it all happened. But I do remember those four and thinking like, oh my gosh, we have not been to church in this time. We like the people at the church didn't show up ever, which is wild because like you're a pastor, you'd think that someone would have shown up with a meal or to see your kid or something, but no one ever did. And I was just like, wait, why do I feel so free? Why do I feel so much happier not being in the church? And then as soon as I got back from leave, I was like, I don't want to work here anymore. And I think maybe that was just really obvious or something, because then within a couple months I was laid off. There's just so much freedom now. I haven't been in the church for 2 years. 10 out of 10 recommend.
Yeah, I haven't stepped foot in a church, in that church, since mid-February of 2020.
Yeah.
And for me, the big slap you across the head type of moment was when Sean had said, when do you want to go back? Because we were talking about getting vaccinated. And at that point, we were on the cusp of having vaccines. And he's okay, when we get the kids vaccinated, when do you want to go back? And I didn't know how to get the bravery to tell him, I don't want to go back. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know. I thought, oh my gosh, he's like trying to lead our family, right?
God bless him.
And yeah. And what is really going on in his brain is, I don't want to go back either. Neither of us wanted to, but he felt like he was supposed to fulfill that quote, godly role. Mm-hmm. And we were losing excuses. And I sat with that for a second and I was like, okay, I'm going to have to give him an answer because he wants to dialogue about this. And I noticed that my heart had started racing. My thoughts were racing. I just didn't feel like myself. And I, instead of judging that, I thought, I'm going to sit with this for a second. And I realized that I had grown up and had sustained this mindset of absolutely hating and berating myself my entire life. And I had began to accept and love myself for who I was. And I knew at that moment, I could not walk back into the doors of a place that put me in a position where I hated myself again, because I knew that I had to hate myself in order to continue ministry. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that as soon as I walked into a church building, my value decreased by a large percentage because of my gender. And I couldn't put my daughter through that. Yes. And I couldn't teach my boys that was acceptable. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was it. I just thought, I'm not going back. I can't do it.
I think it's so wild that often, or like what it used to be, like when I first started ministry, like 15 years ago, the thought process was, when people have kids, they'll come back to church. Oh, millennials are leaving the church in droves. When they have kids, they'll come back. And it's so funny because for us, it was, we had kids and so we left. we didn't want this for them. We wanted better.
Yeah. It was the hardest decision I have ever made in my entire life because it did. It cost me everything. Mm-hmm. I'm no contact with my family now because mm-hmm. that's how that works. But I'm no longer in a space where I look at these journal entries, these prayer journal entries. And if I knew somebody, if I had a friend that said half of those things, I would move heaven and earth to put them in a hospital and put them on suicide watch. It's not okay, the things that I was saying. Although I can look back and I didn't have suicidal ideations. I thought that I was fine. I thought that you're supposed to hate yourself that much and you're supposed to be that miserable to be a Christian.
Yes.
And that's where I was supposed to be at. That was the joy of the Lord.
Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you to those that have reached out with your support. Whether you have left a review, if you haven't left a review, this would be a really, really good time to leave a review. Read every single one of them. So thank you. And for those that are subscribers to my Patreon, thank you. It means so much. One of the new features that I am adding for my paid Patreon subscribers is the chat feature. And this is just a way that we can all continue this conversation that we're having in the podcast. And if you are not a paid subscriber, unfortunately, the chat feature won't be available to you, but you can be a free subscriber and you'll just get the weekly newsletters. Y'all are amazing. And I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
And
yeah, I've never loved myself more since leaving the church. I've never felt more worthy, more just like whole. I was like this broken mess of a human when I was at church. And in the last 2 years, I'm just like, oh, this new version of me. Hello. Like, where have you been all my life? And I'm excited to talk about the whole Dobson focus on the family thing, because what's funny for my story is that the first person in my family to start deconstructing was my dad. And it was when I was in seminary and a pastor, and he's asking me these questions. And I'm like panicking because he's asking me like these questions that I'm just like, you're not allowed to ask those things. And asking me like, have you read the Book of Enoch? You know, and just like all of this stuff. And like, he was a really big Michael Heiser fan. And I'm just like, why are you asking? Like, why can't you just leave it up to faith? Why is faith not enough? And my dad's just, because it's not. And then he got me into it and searching. And so I just think it's so funny that the guy who was drilling home respect and focus on the family and I'm the umbrella of protection and all of that ridiculousness was then like, actually, I think this whole thing is bullshit.
Yeah.
Sorry, am I allowed to cuss on here? I should have asked that. Okay, cool. No.
Yeah, knock yourself out. Say a stream of curse words. It's fine.
Okay, great. Perfect.
Your kids might be able to hear it at some point.
Nothing that they haven't heard.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, you can't listen to my podcast. Like I tell my teenagers that, do not. Because it comes up for suggestions. Like when they...
Oh, no way. That's so funny.
Yeah, I love that. They're like, oh, mom, I saw your podcast. You can't listen to it. Please don't listen to it. Because you're going to have questions. And I actually do not have the time and space and capacity in my life right now to answer all of the questions that are going to rabbit trail from this right now. So
yeah, no, you're like, please. I'm happy to answer them as they come up, but this is rapid fire and I can't do it.
Exactly. Nope. I just don't have that. Okay. Let's rewind. Because now we know the end story that you were a pastor, that you've deconstructed. Let's go back. And I think that what we had talked about, so we talked yesterday and there's a lot that we can go into in the beginning stages of your life that you went through private school from a Baptist church, but your journey is so centered around high school and college and then coming out of college, especially in regards to purity culture. What do you remember mostly about purity culture? What do you remember from Dobson? What do you remember from True Love Waits? I know, right? True Love.
Right? I'm like, oh my gosh, I just had a physical reaction. Yeah, my parents, okay, so I was born into the Assemblies, and then from the Assemblies, we went to the Baptists. So it's just a recipe for disaster, right? I wish that people could see the look on your face right now. Yeah. So yeah, that was a very weird thing. And in general, in my life, my parents would often church hop. Like we'd be at a church for a decade or something, and then off we go somewhere else for a few years, and then off we go. So I had so many different theologies put into me. And so sometimes it was Dobson. Sometimes, so like my cousins were IBLP. And so we got little snippets of that. And just a lot of, just a mess of narratives. And my parents, what I'm realizing now as an adult, they had no idea what was being taught in Sunday school. And they never asked, because why would they? They just thought, oh, I'm dropping them off at church, it's got to be fine. It's not fine. And as an adult, I've told them some of the things that I learned in the Baptist church, because that's like most of the bulk of my young years and indoctrination, because that was coupled with attending a Baptist school. And so just what we were taught. And for instance, we were taught in, I was taught in first grade that I had to be on my best behavior if I was going to be a good testimony for Christ. So I couldn't talk to my neighbor, because if I talk to my neighbor, then I'm not being a good testimony. So I was probably already predisposed to be a people pleaser based on my personality and who I am. But then I was indoctrinated to be a people pleaser, right?
Yeah.
And so then when you take that and couple it with purity culture, holy shame, Batman. Shame is just like the biggest thing. I remember in my 20s being exposed to Brené Brown and listening to her stuff on shame and just being like, hold up, hang on, what? And just like how a lot of what she has to say just really spoke to my soul, because I'm like, no, my whole life has been, you're a dirty, awful person. And, you know, because of that, there is shame attached to that. And purity culture, I went to Creation Festival every single year growing up. I heard every single, like when I say every single year growing up, I think my first time ever going to Creation Festival, I was in third grade. And I, yeah, just heard all of the purity talks there. I heard all of the purity talks at school, in the church, in youth group. And it's interesting, because I will say I did not hear them from my parents. My parents left most of the discipleship, if you will, up to the church and school. There was very little that actually did happen at home unless we were in trouble. And then it was more like the focus on the family stuff that we experienced was more the discipline angle. And I do remember my mom, like we'd drive around and she'd be listening to James Dobson on the radio, his radio show and stuff. But yeah, and in terms of purity culture, a lot of it came from youth group and all of that kind of stuff. When we're passing around a rose, and by the time youth group's over, the rose makes it back up to the front, and look at how nasty and dirty this is because everybody's touched it and it's wilted and awful. That's your virginity. And just all of these really awful, awful narratives of God can't use you if you don't save yourself for marriage. If you have premarital sex, God can't use you. What? And when I was 18, I was sexually assaulted by the guy that I had been dating for 2 years. I thought I could trust him. I thought everything was fine. I didn't even know that it was sexual assault until I was in my 20s and I was married. I had no idea what had happened to me. All that I know is that I said no, and it happened anyway. But I didn't receive sex ed because I'm a woman. I can't handle that.
You know? Oh, our brains. Aren't they small? I don't know.
I was science.
Anatomy.
But yeah.
We're kidding, by the way, those that are listening, where there's complete and utter sarcasm. You can hear us laughing.
Sarcasm is dripping.
Yeah.
But yeah. So then the shame that already you get from religion, but then with it heaped up on top of this experience. And oh my gosh, I didn't save myself for my husband, thinking I put myself in this situation. It's my fault. I allowed this to happen because my no wasn't strong enough, or whatever it was. I shouldn't have ever been at an older guy's apartment. because he was 2 years older than me and had his own place. So I should never have even been at his house. I put myself in a bad situation. How could I have done this to myself?
So I think also we're taught through purity culture to not say no to a guy. We are not, girls are not taught the word no. Children are not taught the word no. We talk a lot about women and girls being sexually assaulted and being raped. But the boys are being sexually assaulted and boys are being raped as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah. Because
they are not taught that they have a voice when they're children.
Right.
We're just taught that if it happens, you were the one that went there. You put yourself in that position. You sent the mixed message. Mm-hmm. It's your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
What was he supposed to do? Yeah. Look at you. You're beautiful. What is he supposed to do? It's just,
yeah,
it's this boys will be boys. And I know inside of bringing up boys, it's heavily talked about. Mm-hmm. Just this idea that boys can't resist.
Yeah.
That it's impossible for them.
And yeah. And it's interesting because, so my husband was not raised evangelical. He converted if you will. I don't know. How do you convert from nothing? But anyway, he got captured. Right. Yes. There it is.
Born again.
When he was 16, I want to say maybe 15, but like somewhere in that age range. Mm-hmm. And his development of theology and all of that kind of stuff, purity culture, if you will, was done through our high school youth group. And both, we went to the same high school. He's older than me, but shared experience there. And he told me that anytime that there was like a purity talk and like then guys and girls broke apart or whatever, he said that he was always told boys will be boys. Try to not have sex before you're married. Also, porn's bad. And that was it. Meanwhile, we're getting our worth attached to this. And it's horrible. It's so horrible.
When you are in college, you're starting to put the pieces together of, oh my gosh, this is what happened. Also, you believe that you have a calling on your life to be a certain thing. You're starting to ask questions. That is a pretty intense, heavy intersection mm-hmm. that you're finding yourself in.
Yeah. So the sexual assault happened the spring of my senior year of high school. And then I purposely chose a college that was a mountain pass or two between me and the boyfriend, because I was, and I just remember praying, God, make him fall out of love with me. Just let him let me go. And that never happened. And so finally I was home for Christmas break. I tried to be strong. I tried to break up with him. I couldn't do it. Cause again, I didn't know how to advocate for myself. That was something that I learned way later in life. And yeah. Then I did end up breaking up with him, but he kept, a month later, I came home for what we called J term. And he would text me and be like, where are you? Why aren't you home? Your car's not in your driveway. So he was stalking me, and it was crazy. The whole entire situation was nuts. And so then I'm dealing with the shame. I'm also dealing with being hypervigilant because I'm terrified that this person is going to come and do something horrible. I don't know. And finally, I went back to college. I almost dropped out because at that point, I'm like massive imposter syndrome, right? Like I'm a music major. I am only getting a music degree because God called me to be a worship pastor.
Yes.
Yeah. I did not play an instrument. I did not read music. I just sang. And I went to a school in this state that is quite known for their music program and got a traditional music degree from the school. I had no business there. I had no business. I grinded and I worked really freaking hard and I've forgotten most of it. In the process of college, I'm taking ministry courses, but mostly the ministry courses were on accident. I would just take the theology classes because I enjoyed them and I enjoyed the professors. And it was a different theology than I had ever been taught. It was progressive and mm-hmm. it was different. And so I just remember thinking like, I need to learn this because this is unlike anything that I've ever heard before. It's not topical preaching. It's exegesis. It's pulling out all of, you know, the stuff, and I'm learning Greek and Hebrew and what? And just this whole thing, it was just mind-blowing to me. And then learning that you are not the decisions that you've made. You are not the choices that you've made. You are not defined by experiences that have happened to you in your life. You are defined by your character. You're defined by who you are as a person. And so then realizing I can still do ministry if I want. And so at that point, me and my husband now had started dating. In that time period, we got married because we couldn't keep our hands off of each other. So we had to get married.
Of course not. Yeah, you have to get married. That's
I'm so grateful that it worked out for us and that we've been married for 11 years and we're happy, because that is not the case for a lot of people.
Yeah. Look, Sean and I have had to unpack the serious trauma bond that we established our entire relationship on.
Yeah.
And we've been married for 19 years, together for 21.
Wow.
But yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And the unpacking happens in layers. It's not, especially when you escape a cult you've been in your entire life.
Yes. Yeah. And like we met in the cult, like we met.
Yes.
Because we were both in the same youth group. It doesn't matter that he was a senior when I was a freshman. Don't worry. We didn't date in high school, guys. We didn't date in college. But like when you can, so I remember going to camp. He was one of the leaders of the camp. And I remember him and I were like partnered up to pray for other kids. And because I was a leader, but I was a youth leader. And I just remember hearing him pray and just being like, I hope that my husband prays like that. And I hope that the man that I marry someday, I just hope that he prays just like that.
How's that prayer going now?
So we pray together every night. That's funny though, because we used to, right? Before we go to bed, right? You hold hands and you
pray.
What
was that? Nightlight? Nightlight was the Dobson devotions.
Oh, okay. Luckily we did not get those. But I did get some really awful book.
The Act of Marriage?
No. It was something about like, the godly wife or something like that.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I had, oh gosh, was it by Beverly LaHaye?
It may have been. Okay. All I know is that my friend gave it to me for a wedding gift, or maybe even at the bachelorette party. It was something really cringe and
biblical woman.
Something. Yeah. I
was given The Act of Marriage by Tim and Beverly LaHaye, and that is horrible. It's completely male centered. And I could do lots of stuff on that, but you got, you prayed together.
Yeah. And we tried to go through love and respect together. Gosh. Yeah. I'm just like going to keep naming out all these buzzwords. And like we read Wild at Heart and Captivating together when we were dating. Mm-hmm. And we'd each read a chapter and then compare notes because we were long distance, because I was on the east side of the state going to college and he was on the west. And yeah, so we would just read these books and then talk about them and what do we want our relationship to look like and all that cringy nastiness. And then we did Love and Respect, and we literally didn't make it past the first chapter, because it basically, if anyone else has had the pleasure of reading it, it basically says everything is the woman's fault. Supposedly, I hear that the next chapter gets better and that the men get drugged through it, but not anything like the women. And I was just like, no, absolutely not. No. And so part of, let's say, the problem with me in terms of the church is that I am very opinionated. I am very headstrong, and I don't fit into the normal mold of the Christian woman. I had to be, I don't want to say I had to be convinced to have kids. I never planned to have kids until me and my husband got together and I was like, oh, we'd make cute babies. Sure. Let's have one. And then we accidentally got pregnant and I was like, oh, okay. But that was like 5 years into marriage, because like I say, I was not trying to have kids anytime soon. I just didn't want to. Now, don't worry. I'm grateful, kids. If you're older and you're listening to this, I love you.
You were definitely planned.
Yeah, totally. But I was not a volunteer in the nursery type. I was just, I'm not. That's not me. And so reading that book, whatever the heck the book was, the something godly wife, I don't know. I was just so cringed the whole entire time. I was like, this is not me. And I feel like I have to be true to myself, but also I'm supposed to be this godly woman. I'm supposed to be who God wants me to be. But the first seed of deconstruction that happened in me was me asking the question of, if God didn't want me to be the way that I am, why would he have created me this way? Why would he have made me like this if the whole point was to try to emulate and be someone else?
Yes.
That does not make sense.
Yes.
And so I have always felt that tension inside of me. And so we started going to counseling together when we, I think, had been married for about 7 years. And there's nothing wrong. We were each other's best friends. We were great. But trying to figure out, how can we continue to be in love in 50 years? How is this going to be that when our kids are raised and they're out of the house, we're not terrified at that prospect because now we have to be alone together? Yeah. And so to anyone listening, if you're married, go to counseling before you have problems because you learn such incredible tools. And that's what we did. And in those counseling sessions, I would say, I feel like I'm failing as a wife. And Joey's like, why? Why do you feel like that? And I'm like, I'm not making you lunch every day. I'm not always making dinner every night. The house is always a mess. I'm dealing with depression. We might not have sex often enough. You were whatever it was. And he was just like, where on earth did these expectations come from? We have never verbalized any of these expectations in our marriage. So for some reason, you have this idea of what a perfect marriage looks like in your head. And first off, this is my husband saying, I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. That is not the picture of a perfect marriage to me. And second, we've got to figure out where this is coming from because this is not realistic and it's not us. We make our own rules for our own marriage, not anyone else. And then that's when I realized, James freaking Dobson told me that this is how a marriage is supposed to look. And the evangelical church and any stupid Bible study that I've ever had to do in a women's group told me that this is the expectation. And my husband's, no, slag that. That's not happening. That's not us. And spoiler alert, my husband's the one who deconstructed before me. And then when I started deconstructing, he was like, thank God I haven't believed this stuff for years. And I'm like, what? He's like, I can't tell you that because you're a pastor. So I can't tell you that I don't believe it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was wild.
So what was the moment like when you put the proper language to the sexual assault?
Yeah, so that would have been... So the sexual assault happened in 2009 and I didn't put together what it was and label it sexual assault until I was telling my counselor about it in 2014 or 15.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was 5 or 6 years after it happened it had really affected our marriage. I would get flashbacks and trauma and stuff. And I prayed and prayed and the prayers didn't do anything. And then all of a sudden I was severely depressed and I had suicidal ideation and I was just an absolute mess. And I didn't understand why. And I didn't want to go on antidepressants because if I go on antidepressants, then that just means that my faith isn't good enough. And I'm trying to be in ministry. I can't admit that I don't have enough faith. And me and my husband, me and Joey, we don't fight very often. That's just not us. That's not our communication style. But one of the biggest fights that we've ever had was the night that he cried, I cried, and he begged me to go on antidepressants because he didn't want to lose his wife. And so I started taking antidepressants and I started going to therapy and I told my therapist and I was shocked. I was like, maybe I didn't tell the story.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, no, I get how you could have gotten there, but I put myself in the situation. I
shouldn't have ever done that. I shouldn't have been there. I was being dumb. It was my fault. You said no. And he did it anyway. That is the definition of rape. And I was like, on one hand, it made me feel less shame a little bit, because then it wasn't like, oh my gosh, it's not that I didn't save myself for marriage. It's this other thing. But it also made me feel like, wow, dummy, you went and got yourself raped. You know what I mean? I still felt like it was my fault.
Yes.
Yeah. Just there was no grace for myself. Having grace for myself is only something that has started happening since leaving the church.
Yep.
Yeah.
I read something today. One of my friends had posted this and said, the day I left the church, the day I walked out of the church is the day that my trauma stopped. And I sat with that, with those words for a second, because I didn't know that I was being traumatized when I was in the church. So for me, it feels like trauma started after.
Mm.
No, recovery started. I'm so empowered when I think about what it took to end that trauma. And I think about what it took for you to end that trauma. And it's substantial. What was Joey's reaction to all of this?
I will say, in general, most of my aha moments, I have them, whether it's in counseling, whether it's just like a normal, just happens, random little light bulb comes on. Whenever I go and tell Joey, he's just like, huh? sometimes it's because he feels like I need to have those insights on my own, and that it can't be him telling me stuff. Because he's, that's not my job. My job's not to just pick out all of your little blind spots or tell you all of these different things. A lot of life you have to figure out on your own, which I do appreciate, but also it gets really frustrating sometimes as well. But again, before leaving the church, I used to tell people that Joey knows me better than I know me. And he did. He genuinely did. He knew me physically better than I knew me. He knew me emotionally better, spiritually, mentally, all of it. And I don't know why that is. And actually, maybe that's the next topic for therapy. For whatever reason, I didn't have permission to know myself. Or I was afraid to know myself. I was very afraid. Two, something that I enjoy doing is we go floating. I don't know if anyone has been floating, but we go to float tanks, and it's sensory deprivation. And it's just this tank filled with salt water, and you just lay there in silence. If you are a parent and you have children, 10 out of 10 recommend. It's fantastic. And the first time that we did that, I hated it. Oh my gosh, I hated it. I was just like, I am alone with my thoughts. And it was terrifying. Terrifying. And then the next time that we did it, like a year later, I was like, yeah, I'll give it a try again. Again, I don't like what is happening in my brain when everything else isn't there. When I can't scroll my phone, when I can't look at something, when I am laying in pitch black, utter darkness, I don't like this. And as I have left the church, as I have healed, I'm now in religious trauma therapy. As I have done a ton of work on myself, now I lay in that float tank and I'm just like, this is bliss. I love myself. I love my brain. I love the way it works. I'm proud of myself. And on days that I'm like having a rough day, I'll lay there in complete utter darkness and just be like, you are whole. You are lovely. You are not too much for people. You fill up just as much space as you're supposed to. And I just speak affirmations over myself. And I'm like, this is a spiritual experience. And yet it has nothing to do with God.
Yep. It's, who we have become post this. It is. It's incredible. And when I first approached you and said, will you be on this podcast? Like, I'm going to do a podcast called Focus on Your Own Family. And I will never forget your response. Hell yeah, I'll be on that. Because that man has ruined my entire family and my entire life.
I think I said that asshole has ruined
my Yeah, you definitely did.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Because one of the things that when we were talking previously to this, I said it's so interesting that James Dobson's goal was to galvanize the family unit, was to almost just put it in gold. Just you've got the white family, the toxic masculine man, super submissive woman. They've got four children and they're on the crusade to be the next army of the Lord. We're in the Lord's army.
Yes.
And right. And what he has done is destroyed the very fabric of the family by trying to create this utopian family. He's destroyed us. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with that right now. I'm dealing with it in another way because I'm no contact with my parents because they will follow Dobson till the end of time. But you're experiencing it in such a unique way. And it starts with the strong-willed child, but not you. You weren't the strong-willed child. So mm-hmm. Let's talk.
Yeah. This is just raw because it's happening now and it doesn't make sense, but it does. It's just, there's so much to it, but I'm just like, how deep, like how much of a backstory do you have in order to really understand it? So I am one of three children. I'm the youngest. I have two older brothers. My brothers are 20 months apart or something. So very close in age. And then I am 4+ years younger than my next sibling.
And I think something that's going to help you is that those that listen understand what it's like. So I was the strong-willed child. Mm-hmm. However, I've had a lot of people email me and DM me saying, I wasn't the strong-willed child, but my sibling was, and I watched what they went through. So there's a lot of people. Okay. So you don't have to give that backstory because I think a lot of people understand when you say, I wasn't the strong-willed child, mm-hmm. my sibling was, and I saw that.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So my middle brother, the middle child, and he was labeled everything, right? He was labeled the middle child. He was labeled the problem child. He was labeled the strong-willed child. And I don't know if a lot of his strong-willedness came from losing my sister at a young age. There was a sister in between me and him, and she was full-term stillborn. And so he would have been 2.5-ish when she would have been born. And my mom was absent. She was dealing with grief. She was dealing with loss. And he did not have emotional needs met at a very young age. So my dad was raised in a very, so my parents were both indoctrinated into Christianity as well. And so that's what's wild about deconstructing and getting out of it. It's that I was indoctrinated by someone who was indoctrinated by people who are indoctrinated. And so it's just like this generational thing. And my dad was beat as a child, right? Don't get me wrong. It was the 60s and 70s. And so parenting was different. But so one, that was modeled to him. Then two, Dobson said, that's what you do. And so my brother is mouthing off or whatever. Okay, yeah, you're going to get a spanking. You're going mm-hmm. to be disciplined in that way. The joke, which is just like dark humor. But if you experience this, you get it. It was always like, what were we going to get hit with that day? Was it a paint stir stick? Because my dad was remodeling something and he had some left over. By the way, those hurt really bad. Was it a wooden spoon? Was it a spatula? Was it that my dad was just going to take his belt off real quick and just whip you with it? Or was it a different belt that was hanging up that, go get the belt, whatever. And I did receive some of that. I was spanked a lot less than my brothers, especially my middle brother, largely because my parents quickly found out that if they said, I'm disappointed in you, that just broke my spirit and broke my heart, and they didn't need to do anything physical. But my brother did. My middle brother, he always used to say that I was the perfected version of him. We were very similar. We were very alike, but I knew how to get away with stuff without getting in trouble for it or without getting hit for it, which I would say is true. But I would also say that we were raised by different parents. And my cousin and I were talking about this, that every child is raised by different parents. You had the same physical parents, but your parents are growing up with you. And so your parents are learning as they go. Even what I am experiencing, my oldest child, it got different parents than my daughter. That's just a part of the human experience, I think. And anyway, there were times, there were a couple times that I can definitely see that that it wasn't just that when my brother was getting spanked, it was abuse. And saying that feels like a betrayal to my parents, because that is so not where they are anymore. And that is what I think is very interesting about this story and very uncommon with other people who have been raised in jobs and homes. My parents deconstructed. 10 years ago, my parents up and moved to Canada. And being in a different country really opened their eyes to different ways of thinking and different lifestyles. And they have come to all of us kids and they have said, I am sorry. And it sucks because you hear your parents say, I'm sorry, I didn't know. I thought that I was doing what was best. I really thought I was. You go to church and you're told by your pastor that this is the way that you're supposed to parent your kid. And they're preaching this shit from the pulpits. And then you're in small group and you're in whatever other ladies' Bible study or men's prayer breakfast. And it's all the same stuff. And they're talking about the same things. And so we thought that we were doing it right. And it wasn't until getting out of the church that we realized we messed up and we are so sorry. For me and my oldest brother, who have also left the church, we're like, yeah, we're parents too. Parenting is the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. Yeah. And we have grace for our parents and we have forgiveness for them. And my middle brother does not feel that way. And so he has no contact with our whole family now. It started just no contact with my parents, and it has evolved into no contact with my whole family. He claims that it's because he's triggered whenever he's around me, because I remind him of childhood. And I think a lot of that is, it's this hard thing of respecting someone's journey and their healing journey. And also, where the heck did you get this from? So that is what's hard. But I will also say that one of the most damning things about James Dobson, about Focus on the Family, about evangelicalism in general, because I really think that you can't have modern day evangelicalism without the shitty teachings
yes.
of James Dobson and yes. so many others. But I really think that the thing that is the shittiest is that we were taught that we are in charge of people's salvation.
Yeah.
We were taught that you have to go and save people. And I don't know if you remember this, and it's like spotty on who does remember it, so I don't know which denomination this came from, but I was taught that when I get to heaven someday, I'm getting a crown and I will have as many jewels in my crown as souls I have saved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's Assemblies of God.
I think it is too. That feels very
Assemblies yeah. of God.
It's just fascinating because I know that a lot of people who were raised in these environments have ended up with very unfortunate marriages, lives, whatever, because they see themselves as needing to intercede in someone's life in order to save them, even if it's not on account of God anymore.
I'm sorry you're going through that. And it absolutely is because of this junk, this crap that we had to grow up with. I remember my mom, still to this day, in fact, anytime that she felt persecuted, she, and I say persecuted with air quotes, because I mean, seriously, it was, I know Jesus is building that extra wing in my mansion in heaven. Mm-hmm. That's what that meant.
Yep.
That's it. You got a bigger mansion.
Yep.
And it becomes so selfish. Everything is about your mansion in heaven. Nothing for evangelicals is about helping your neighbor, is about helping somebody else. It's about, if I help this person, it's going to make my mansion bigger in heaven. That is everything that it's about. So if I'm beating my child, it's because I'm creating a better Christian soldier.
Yeah.
Because it hurts me more than it hurts them. So this is persecution that I'm having to go through to create a family that represents Jesus. And it's disgusting. What are you doing today to break this trauma cycle?
I'm in religious trauma therapy. That's absolutely fantastic. I have also gone through liminal space therapy.
Can you explain liminal?
I would love to. Yeah. The word liminal means like threshold, and it's talking about those threshold moments of your life. And so those moments that you are in transition. And so I started that when I was thinking about leaving my job at the church. And it just so happened that I had already had a session when I got laid off. And so it was perfect. And I did that for the first like 6 months of my time that I was laid off. And it really helped with that transition a ton. And in that sort of therapy, we spend a lot of time mining for origin stories. And so you're looking at, why do I think the way I do? For instance, in my mind, I have this idea that I can't quit something. Once I've committed to it, I can't quit it. Why? If we mine through the stories, I've got my dad telling me that we don't quit. We don't quit. That's not something that we do. We see mm-hmm. our commitments through. And then I'm taken back to all of a sudden being a third grader on a select soccer team with a verbally abusive coach and begging my parents to let me quit that team and them telling me we don't quit. And so because of that, whenever I'm in any abusive situation or anything that might be uncomfortable or whatever, I have in my mind, but I don't quit. I'm not a quitter. And so having to understand, what is that? What is the origin story? And then how do we rewrite that? And so I have rewritten it as, we quit things that are abusive.
Yeah.
We uphold our commitments, but not if it means compromising our integrity, ourselves, yeah. our physical, mental well-being. So liminal space therapy is amazing. I'm actually going to work to become certified and be a liminal guide. And that's my plan for my next career. And then, yes, continuing in religious trauma therapy and looking at my parenting style and how do I gentle parent when that was not modeled to me? And there's a difference between gentle parenting and permissive parenting. What is the difference? When reading books and trying to understand, how can I love my kids in really positive ways? My son was having a full-on meltdown last week because we were leaving a friend's house and he wasn't quite ready to go yet. And so he was just losing his mind, and we're getting him in his car seat and he's just screaming at us and he's so angry. And like my knee-jerk reaction is, my blood is boiling. I'm going to scream at you. That's what was modeled to me. And instead, I told my husband, pull over the car. And so pulled over, went into the back, and I just hugged him. And I just held him really tight. And I just hugged him for 30 solid seconds and started to breathe deeply. And little by little, he started to calm down. He started to match my breathing. And then I looked back and I was like, are you okay? And he's, yeah. Okay. Can we calm down and can we make it home? Yeah. Thanks, Mom. And then we held hands the rest of the way home.
And so just meeting my kids where they are and trying and failing often, but really trying to just not parent the way that I was parented. And it's hard for me, again, to say stuff like that because it makes me feel like I'm betraying my parents when I love my parents and I have so much respect for them and, again, have extended so much grace to them, knowing that parenting is freaking so hard. And again, they were a part of a cult. cult, and they didn't know any better. And so giving space to, giving space to be able to say what they did was wrong and the way that we were parented was probably not great, but also giving space to be able to say, but I love you and I forgive you, and moving on in that relationship as well. And then when it comes to my brothers, one of the brothers, my oldest, we're just trying to just move on with life and support each other and be there for each other as best as we can. And the other brother, it's just hoping that someday we can have a relationship, but so much in life would have to change. And my son has been asking to see him and his children for a year and a half. And he asks all the time, when can we see them? When can I see my cousins? Because he adores them. And having to tell my son, I'm sorry, we can't see them anymore. And that breaks my heart and that makes me mad. And it's okay if you're mad. You're allowed to have any emotion that you want to have about this. And I promise that whatever emotion you feel, I've probably felt it too. but just trying to move forward, trying to move on and lead with love. As churchy as that sounds, it's just true. Like, that is what my husband and I have settled on, is that we have decided that we are led by love. And so that is our first response toward anyone in any situation, is being love for someone.
What I hear you talking about when you talk about parenting, you give your kids permission to have feelings and emotions, and you don't condemn them for having feelings and emotions. You name them.
Yes.
Which helps them work through those. Mm-hmm. You're not teaching them to spiritually bypass at a young age, oh, just pray about it, rather than experiencing it. And that's so healthy. And I remember, oh my gosh, as soon as I said that, I felt like, oh,
can the worship team please come up?
Yeah, can the worship team come forward, please? And it's just soft piano. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. MC in the back. I can hear in the in-ears. We're good. but I remember something you told me about your daughter. You walked into a room and you can tell she immediately felt uncomfortable. And instead of forcing her into a space where she had to be small and ignore her experiences. And by the way, this is when she was tiny, because she still is so tiny. Mm-hmm. This was like front pack wearing.
I think she had just learned to walk. So she was maybe like 14, 15 months old.
Yeah. This is tight. She's always been so perceptive and, but you brought her into a space and you could tell she did not feel safe. Mm-hmm. Something was off. And instead of saying, no, I'm the parent, you're the child, you're going to stay here and you're going to stop your whining. You're going to stop your crying and you're just going to suck it up. And instead of doing that, you picked her up and you said, I see that you don't feel safe. Let's go find a place where you do feel safe. And she's 14 or 15 months, but that's telling her at that age, it's okay to be safe. Mm-hmm. It's okay. It's okay to want to be safe.
Yeah.
And your intuition is real. Mm-hmm. And you're going to follow that and you're going to trust that. And I'm going to support that. And I'm going to help you on that journey, because that's not something that we got as girls.
Yes.
And you're starting that at such a young age. And I'm just so impressed by that. And it's beautiful. It's just so beautiful. And I think what you and I came to the conclusion of is that it was a really big space and that can be so intimidating for kids. But it doesn't matter if it was a big space or a small space. There could have been one person in there that she absolutely just did not trust. Mm-hmm. And you gave her permission to honor her intuition, and you honored her intuition. And I think that is beautiful. And that's how we end the trauma cycle. That is how James Dobson's legacy dies when he dies.
I know, what a day that'll be.
Yes. But that's what I've said is I know that all of those people, Gothard, the Pearls, Ezzo, and Dobson, I don't even know if Ezzo's even alive. Anyway, I know that they're getting up there in age. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long, nobody knows how long they have on this earth, but my goal is to make it very uncomfortable for them and to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And that this legacy, because they're all about family legacy, like they're obsessed with it.
Yeah.
That's something that I know is written in all of his books. He talks ad nauseum about leaving this legacy. My hope is that this legacy that they have, that they think they've created, ends when they end.
Yeah.
Because we're only going to get louder. Mm-hmm. So,
We're only going to keep deconstructing. Let's just be honest. That Relevant magazine article or whatever that just came out saying that like more and more Americans are either unchurched or leaving religion as a whole. It's like the trend is going to continue and we're going to stop being influenced by your doctrine and your dogma. And actually we're teaching our kids the opposite. So sorry, your legacy isn't for shit.
Yeah. Congratulations. You got our parents.
There it is.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. I'm so thankful for you. I'm so thankful that we treaded lightly to find out that we can trust each other, because you've been I hate saying a gift because it feels like you were born for me and that's weird and it feels evangelical, but I'm so thankful that in what I did not know was the darkest time of my life, that I had somebody as fantastic as you. So I'm so thankful. And we escaped and we made it out.
We fucking did it.
We fucking did it. Let's get loud.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'll talk to you later. Okay.
Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure that you are kind to yourself and to others. If you are interested in supporting this show, please click the link at the bottom to my Patreon. These shows take a lot of time and resources, and any support is appreciated. If you are interested in being a guest, please email the show at focusonyourownfamilypodcast@gmail.com. Inside of the show notes, you will find the links to mine and the guests' socials. Please give us a follow. We look forward to talking with you and connecting with you.